differences. Cats' pupils aren't round like ours. Instead, they have a vertical slit shape that allows them to respond faster to light and open and close more and in all directions. Cats' eyes are slower to focus because the lens of the eye is stiff. And when the pupils are highly constricted, such as in bright daylight, it is actually more difficult for them to focus. Humans have a fovea, which is a tiny pit in the retina that is specialized for seeing details. Cats instead have a visual streak, which serves a similar function but is densely packed with rods, giving cats better vision under low light conditions. Behind the retina, cats have reflective cells called tapetum lucidum. These cells are like a built-in flashlight, providing cats with a signal boost under low light conditions. Incidentally, they are also what makes your cat's eyes glow when you take a picture of them with flash. Hearing. As with their touch and vision, cats' hearing is also an important tool in their HCKE routine. Cats have the broadest hearing range of the carnivores, 10.5 octaves. Cats and humans have a similar range at the low end of the scale, but cats can hear much higher pitched sounds, like mouse squeaks, than we can, about 1.6 octaves above the sounds we hear. Most aspects of a cat's hearing are related to detecting prey rather than communicating with other cats. The cat's outer ear boosts frequencies and is shaped to literally funnel hard-to-detect sounds into the ear canal for better analysis. Their ability to move each ear separately allows cats to pinpoint the source of a sound, be it a prey animal, a predator, or a distressed kitten crying for mom. They can also rotate each ear almost 180 degrees, allowing cats to be aware of anyone coming at them from behind. Now, equipped with a better understanding of how cats' physiology and anatomy support them as master hunters, let's look at a few particulars about how and what they kill. Smaller than a pigeon. Killing in the real world. Cats will hunt anything that is smaller than them, but they tend to prefer prey that is smaller than a pigeon. Their favorite prey is small rodents, with birds as a close second. Cats may also hunt bugs, reptiles, and amphibians. Recent studies have shown that domestic cats, like their cougar cousins, have individual preferences for prey. Most cats are specialists. They hunt just one or two prey types. But some cats are generalists with a wider range of prey preferences. Anything that moves. Birds are a little harder for cats to catch, which is probably why the free-living cat diet is over 75% rodent. Prey preferences can be influenced by what's available, and even by what a mom cat brought to her kittens when they were young. The bottom line is that hunters must adapt, so if there are fewer mice available, cats must hunt birds, or go hungry. This leads us to cats' preferred hunting styles, which are no doubt influenced by their food source of choice. Individual cats show different strategies for killing, some preferring to ambush from an open clearing, stalk and rush from behind cover, wait for their prey to pop out of entrances to burrows and warrens. Don't forget, this applies to all cats, which means that your innocent indoor companion will have a preference in hunting style as well. It will be your job to discover this individual hunting sweet spot when we talk about cat play in Chapter 7. Going in for the kill. Typically, cats grab prey with their paws first, then dig in with their teeth, finishing the job with a kill bite to the nape of the neck, placed specifically to sever their prey's spinal cord. If they're unsure about the prey's ability to fight back, or they're not very experienced hunters, they may bite multiple times. They may also appear to be playing with their food as they bat at it or toss it about in a torturous fashion. But this isn't because the cat is being cruel. It is actually a strategy used to tire out a dangerous victim, making that final killing bite easier to deliver. Until the bitter end, there is a method to their madness. In addition to the whiskers' role in the final sensory confirmation of a kill, cats also have nerves in their teeth that allow them to detect movement and make small adjustments while biting. All of these fine behavioral details are part of their DNA and allow for an efficient, thorough, and low-risk kill. While all of these components serve to make cats one of nature's most perfect hunters, These are not just a random collection of attributes and talents. They are responses to specific environmental conditions. Likewise, understand that, as both predator and prey, cats have become uniquely adapted to both hunting and protecting themselves. What has made them successful is the fact that they can stay alive and kill with equal skill. For more on this unique blend of talents, and how it specifically influences their behavior and relationships with other inhabitants of their home turf, check out Cat Chess in Chapter 10. Now that we have a better idea of how your cat's body, behavior, and astute hunting prowess have evolved to serve HCKE, it's easy to see how it is an indispensable part of cat mojo. Hunting is pleasurable to cats. And to the raw cat, experiencing pleasure and fulfilling their primary objective mean basically the same thing. Simply put, it is the primary end goal to every cat's day. The biggest favor you can do for your cat is to help the raw cat find a home for his daily super objective within the relatively new and somewhat restrictive confines of your home by establishing a flow of routines, rituals, and rhythm around HCKE. More on this in Chapter 7. Eating. Meat. The whole meat and nothing but the meat. After the hunt, whether it be in the real world or via your faithful reenactment of one during a play session, it's time to eat. And after all that's been discussed so far, it should make perfect sense by now that your cat is not a vegan. No, cats are obligate carnivores. Their digestive system is designed specifically and exclusively to process meat. Likewise, it should come as no surprise that cats, as opportunistic hunters, are not scavengers, and as such, are not digestively built to graze. That doesn't necessarily mean they are meant to eat huge meals either. Opportunistic, by definition, means that whatever presents itself will do, whether a grasshopper enters the crosshairs or a bird. Generally, cats have a weak sense of taste, with fewer taste buds than humans. Their sense of smell is much more useful for them in hunting, and thus important for eating. That sense is so ingrained that congested cats often lose their appetite. It's as if with one frayed wire, the entire machine will go on the fritz. That said, cats can still detect salty, sweet, sour, and bitter, and tend to show dislike for sour and bitter. This is likely a response that evolved to prevent the ingestion of dangerous toxins. Additionally, cats have a taste receptor for adenosine triphosphate, ATP, a molecule that's a source of energy for all living cells. ATP is sometimes referred to as a signal for meat, and, interestingly, we can't taste it. How do cats eat? Cats are opportunistic and will adjust their activity based on food availability. Cats will eat more at one sitting when food is generally less available. One mouse provides about 30 calories, and a typical cat might hunt 10 to 30 times a day in order to obtain around 8 mice. Cats often carry their prey away from where they kill. Cats crouch when they eat, and if their kill is big enough, they may even lie down to eat. You may notice your cat eating with her head tilted. This is an ancestral behavior related to eating their prey from the ground, not from a bowl. Harder-to-chew items usually increase the degree of head tilting. Cats pick up a small amount of food and give a quick shake of the head. This is another ancestral behavior that helps loosen meat from bones and removes feathers from a bird's body. Cats don't do much chewing. Their teeth are designed to tear meat into small strips that can be swallowed. Grooming and sleeping. Cats are naturally fastidious and typically clean from tip to tail, spending 30 to 50% of their waking hours grooming. They let their tongue, which is naturally abrasive, do most of the work, and use their paws to get at hard-to-reach areas. What purpose does grooming serve in the wild? Grooming keeps the coat clean, prevents parasite infestation, and helps cats strengthen their own personal scent while ridding themselves of the smell from their kill, which would attract other predators. As for sleeping, a cat's natural circadian rhythm shifts with the day length and sunlight, much like ours. Cats usually sleep in several short bursts rather than in longer chunks, And like us, they have cycles of deep and light sleep. During deep sleep, you may notice their limbs or whiskers twitching as some of their muscles contract during dreams. But super deep sleep is not something that is achieved every time they lie down. More typically, it's all about catnaps, sleeping lighter for a shorter duration of time. That's life in the middle of the food chain, folks, sleeping with one eye open, both for finding sustenance and for preserving your own life. In the world of kill or be killed, the long and short of it is that a nice deep sleep isn't always the wisest option. Do cats sleep all day? If I asked you what you think your cat is doing while you're at work, I bet you would say one thing. Sleeping. People assume cats sleep all day, but a 2009 study that placed cameras on cats' collars showed that when cats were home alone, they slept only around 6% of the time. In contrast, they spent over 20% of their time looking out the window. If this doesn't impress upon you the importance of cat TV, I don't know what will. More on cat TV in section 3. Are cats nocturnal? It has been widely stated and assumed, most likely by those who are kept up by their hyperactive cats in the middle of the night, that cats are nocturnal animals. Cats are more active at night than we are, but they are not truly nocturnal. Rather, they are crepuscular. Their natural rhythm, devoid of other influences, is to be active at dawn and dusk, just like rodents, their primary prey animal. As you can tell by now, the ancestral cat is absolutely alive and well in every cat, informing each and every aspect of the HCKEGS daily rhythm. That's not where it ends, though. Not by a long shot. If you've ever said to yourself, "I wish my cat could tell me what she's thinking," well, she can, and does. You just have to have your ears to the raw cat in order to hear what your cat has to say. 4. Communication. Cat code cracking. The consistent feedback, or rather the absolute teeth-clenching, neck-vein-popping, eye-rolling frustration that I've encountered over the years from adopters, clients, my cat from hell viewers, and, hell, just strangers on the street, is that cats are inscrutable. There is a pretty volatile combination at play when it comes to the cat-guardian relationship. When we don't understand what cats are trying to communicate through their behaviors, we try to figure it out and are met with a blank stare. That look becomes a blank canvas for all kinds of projections from humans. Let's say you're sitting in the living room watching TV. Your cat comes into the room and, without hesitation, walks up to your gym bag and pees in it. I mean, talk about a potentially explosive moment. What immediately makes a bad situation worse is you executing a slow boil and assuming that you know what he is trying to tell you. I hate my dinner. I hate the fact that you left me for 12 boring hours today, and you do it every single day. I hate your new girlfriend. Or, if you are circling this particular drain, that last big blast of projection, I hate you. Depending on how crappy your day has been up to that point, and perhaps how many times your cat has executed such blood pressure spiking actions in the past, the speed at which your relationship deteriorates can be dizzying and dangerous. I've seen a bond that was already a bit shaky crumble in that moment like a house of cards. And once that house comes down, well, your cat already has a paw out the door. It has been a fundamental part of my job since the beginning to interrupt this downward spiral before it gets to that irreversible point. Don't forget, I began counseling guardians while working at an animal shelter, on the phone as they were asking me how much we charged to take back their cat. I know all too well where that downward spiral leads, to a homeless cat in a cage. Part of the issue is that we, perhaps subconsciously, look at cats through dog-colored glasses. That is to say, we expect them to communicate with us in a way that we can instantly recognize. As you can guess by now, that expectation goes against the entire history of our relationship to cats. We've molded dogs over thousands of years to be recognizable, to reflect humanness back at us. We've bred in attributes that benefit us because, to boil it down, one of our main desires is companionship. That was never the priority in our relationship to and with cats. Remember that it was all about what was mutually beneficial when cats acted as hunters who protected our food supply. So to suddenly expect your cat to change his fundamental communication style after all this time is foolhardy at best. Between the two worlds of humans and cats, the two languages, there is a fence. We must meet at that fence. Dogs will gladly jump the fence and run to our side in order to communicate. Cats simply won't, because that has never, until this point in our relationship, been part of our arrangement. That said, the language of cats is just as eloquent as that of any other species on Earth. You just have to commit to meeting at the communicative fence. From cat-specific vocalizations to body language to behaviors like, yes, peeing, it all adds up to form a linguistic whole that, once learned, will make for a much more fulfilling relationship, and one not fraught with resentment. So let's dig in and start with how cats talk. More than meows, the talkative cat. Chirrups, trills, purrs, yowls, snarls, and of course, meows. Your cat can make up to 100 different sounds, which is more than most carnivores, including dogs. Of course, if you have a chatty catty, that might seem like a lowball estimate. Why do cats have so much to say? Vocalizations can be ferocious or friendly. They might say, stay away, or come closer. Calls can provide information from a greater distance than just body language can, and may even tell the listener how big and strong the sender is. Let's consider three facts. Feral cats are typically quieter than their domestic counterparts. Many vocalizations are directed towards humans, and there is a wide range of individuality when it comes to how talkative a cat is. Genetics may play a part, as some breeds, namely Siamese, Oriental, and Abyssinian, tend to be more vocal than your average cat. But we can assume that we humans have played a large role in how verbose our cats are. After all, meows get attention, which often leads to food, petting, or getting a door opened. It's interesting to note that cats rarely meow at each other, with the key exception being the cry of kittens in distress for their mom. Cats use other sounds to communicate with each other. Some of these sounds, like the meow, start with an open mouth that closes during the sound, such as howls and sexual calls. The less friendly calls are made with the mouth held open. Those yowls, growls, snarls, hisses, and shrieks that are heard during fighting or are a response to pain. Perhaps the cutest and friendliest sound that cats make don't require them to open their mouths at all. Purrs, chirrups, and trills are reserved for greetings and personal contact. What's up with the purr? Purring is one of those mojo mysteries that we still don't totally understand. It is usually a positive response, but sometimes cats purr when they are stressed, in pain, or even dying. Either way, we're pretty sure that the purr is not under the cat's conscious control, but is more like a reflex. The brain sends a signal to the muscles in the larynx, or what we call the voice box. These muscles move the vocal cords at a rate of approximately 25 times per second while cats inhale and exhale, which produces that distinctive rumble we call a purr. Purrs help the raw mom cat keep kittens nearby. The kitten's purrs tell mom they are nearby, and the purr helps with bonding by releasing self-soothing endorphins and lulling the kittens to sleep. Purrs might have healing powers. They are in a similar range, 20 to 140 hertz, to sound frequencies that help with both healing injuries and improving bone density, at least for cats anyway. To date, the evidence on healing human bones is inconclusive. This may help explain why cats who are wounded or sick will often be purring. I've heard speculation that a cat's purrs during the killing bite can aid in lulling the prey into a catatonic state, but they might manipulate us as well. A 2009 study by Dr. Karen McComb and colleagues demonstrated that humans could tell the difference between a purr that a cat was making while soliciting food, which they labeled an urgent purr, from a non-urgent purr. The urgent purrs, including a high-frequency component that indicated some level of excitement that we pick up on, and probably respond to with attention or food. Cat Daddy Fact. The Guinness World Record for the loudest purr is held by Smokey, a British cat, who could purr at 67.7 decibels, about as loud as conversation in a typical restaurant. The Tooth Chatter. It's a common sight. Your cat is staring at a bird through the window, locked in with complete focus. Then this crazy chattering, quacking sound comes out of your cat's mouth. What the heck? Many cats chatter their teeth when they see prey that they can't get to. Some will even chatter at other cats. One idea is that your cat is expressing frustration that they can't get to that delicious bird. Some think the tooth movement is your cat practicing their killer bite. The theory with perhaps the most weight is that cats are mimicking the sounds of their prey. Margays, Amazonian wildcats, mimic the sound of tamarin monkeys to lure them within pouncing distance. A 2013 Swedish study showed overlap between the types of sounds birds make and the sounds emitted by cats during the chatter, including chirps, tweets, and tweedles. Makes sense, doesn't it? The raw cat, more than most predators, will find a novel way to secure its kill. Wolf in sheep's clothing? Try the raw cat in bird's clothing. Anyhow, for now, we'll have to chalk this one up to Mojo Mysteries, but it might be another example of how vocalizations have evolved to help cats get what they need. Body language. Cats tell us a lot through their bodies. While all cats will have subtle differences in how they communicate what they are feeling, whether confident, relaxed, fearful, defensive, or ready to attack, there are some general signals they use with both humans and other cats. Many of these signals are inherited from their raw cat ancestor, which, as you will see, sometimes creates challenges for the modern cat. The tail. A cat's tail serves many purposes. It helps with jumping and balance, and can even provide warmth and protection. But when a cat is sitting or walking slowly, the tail is free to communicate. The cat's tail can send several different messages because the tip can move independently from the rest of the tail. In the raw cat's ancestral environment, grasslands, the tail was likely a good long-distance signal of a cat's emotional state. Strutting by with the tail in the air is a mojo moment. The tail up with a curve at the tip is a classic friendly or playful greeting that says, "Hello," or "Right this way, follow me." As the tail lowers, the message might change a little. An ambivalent tail is slightly lowered, at more of a 45-degree angle. The tail at half-mast, or horizontal to the ground, can be neutral, friendly, or even tentatively exploratory, and requires more contextual information for interpretation. A tail down can serve a few different functions. Cats slightly lower the tail while stalking prey, but a cat might also be trying to make himself smaller by lowering the tail, assuming either a defensive or fearful posture. In extreme cases, the lower tail is accompanied by the army crawl, or walking away from a potential threat quickly and as low to the ground as they can get. The tail between the legs is the most extreme expression of fear. A bristled tail generally signifies DEFCON 1. It can be offensive or defensive, but it is often a response to something alarming in the environment. A quivering tail, sometimes referred to as mock spraying, since that's exactly what it looks like, is usually a sign of positive excitement. In my experience, I've noticed the mock spray directed either at or near a person the cat is fond of. I can only guess that this signifies ownership with a posture that walks the tightrope between confident, body scent marking, rubbing, etc., and unconfident, urine marking, cat language. Either way, I've learned to take it as a pretty high compliment. Tail lashing is often an indicator of impending aggression or defensiveness, while smaller, subtle twitching movements can indicate frustration or irritation. See The Energetic Balloon in Chapter 7 for more on this. Cat Nerd Corner. The Tail Up Studies. In a 2009 study of a feral colony in Italy, cats were observed for 8 months. Researchers noted combative behavior between cats, which included biting, staring, chasing, and fighting. They also noted avoidance behaviors such as crouching, retreating, and hissing, and friendly behaviors, which included sniffing, rubbing, and presenting the tail up. The tail up was most often directed towards aggressive cats by non-aggressive cats, suggesting it might be a message that says, "I come in peace," and could also inhibit aggression in another cat. To further demonstrate that the tail up served the function of expressing, "Hey, I'm friendly," John Bradshaw and Charlotte Cameron Beaumont studied how cats responded to just silhouettes of other cats with different tail positions. This would rule out the possibility that the cats in the study were responding to other things aside from the tail up, like pheromones, vocalizations, or other aspects of an in-person interaction. The results? Cats would approach the image faster and raise their own tails in response to a tail-up silhouette. When they saw the tail-down silhouette, cats tended to respond with tail twitching, or by putting their own tails down. The ears. The ears can move subtly, quickly, and independently, which is why they are often the most telling aspect of a cat's body language. They can be the first indicator of a cat's emotional state. More than 20 muscles control the movements of the ears, and they are always ready to spring into action even when your cat is resting. Upright ears allow cats to take in and respond to auditory information in the environment. For a relaxed cat, the ears will be upright but slightly rotated to the side. When the ears are more forward-facing, your cat is on alert or maybe even frustrated. Flattened ears can mean different things. If the ears are sideways and down, your cat is fearful, but also still trying to get information. The flatter the ears, the more fearful the cat. Complete backward rotation of the ears is getting them out of harm's way in anticipation of an attack. When each ear is doing something different, the interpretation is more ambiguous. And in that moment, so is your cat's emotional state. The eyes. Pupils dilate under low light levels, but they also dilate during the fight-or-flight response. Dilated pupils let in more light and information about the environment. When cats are assessing danger, for instance, more information means securing multiple escape routes. The more dilated the pupils are, the more defensive the cat is probably feeling. On the other hand, a cat with constricted pupils is likely confident and relaxed. However, it's not just about what the eyes are doing. It's also about how exactly they're being used. A stare is usually a challenge, but a cat's degree of focus and distractibility while staring will usually tell you how much of a challenge it really is. A cat who is avoiding eye contact with another cat is typically doing so for a reason, usually to minimize the likelihood of a confrontation. Blinking slowly is a sign of contentment and relaxation, which is why we try to evoke the slow blink when greeting or communicating with a cat. More on this in the Cat Greetings Slow Blink section in Chapter 11. The whiskers. The main function of whiskers is to provide tactile information to a cat, but they also provide us with some information about how relaxed or aroused a cat is. A relaxed cat usually has soft whiskers that are pointing out to the side, while a fearful or defensive cat might flatten the whiskers against the sides of the face as another way of becoming small. Forward-pointing whiskers indicate a cat is trying to get more information, since those whiskers will detect air movements and objects. The more forward-facing the whiskers are, the more attentive the cat is. Forward whiskers could indicate that a cat is about to attack, perceives a threat, or is just plain interested, so, as always, context is important. No single behavior or posture happens in a vacuum, so remember to consider the big picture as you evaluate your cat's state. Is she relaxed on the couch? Staring out the window at another cat? Crouched under your bed? You also have to look at the whole enchilada. Of course, that entails what's coming from the body, tail, eyes, ears, and whiskers, along with vocalizations, but also what's coming from the territory, the other inhabitants, even the time of day. If there's one thing I've learned in translating cat language, it's the importance of context. Body postures. Unlike some animals, cats don't have clear appeasement signals or submissive body language that says, "Please forgive me," probably because such a thought would never occur to them. But this communicative limitation impacts a cat's ability to engage in conflict resolution. How can cats function in this way? Go back to the timeline and look at how recently cats have been social, not just with humans, but with each other. The ancestor cat was not a social species, and these days domestic cats often resolve conflicts through avoidance and defensive behavior, and maintain bonds through a group's scent and signals like the tail up. But understanding the communicative challenges will help you understand why cats sometimes have difficulties with each other. Cats who are upset usually take one of two routes. They can go bigger, with hair on end and expanded posture, i.e., the classic Halloween cat. These cats are on full alert and may be willing to defend themselves if necessary. Straight legs, a puffed tail, and an elevated butt is a cat who is purely on the offense, essentially saying, "Bring it on, I'm ready." Cats who make themselves smaller, on the other hand, are trying to appear unthreatening. Their ears are back, their shoulders are hunched, and they are crouching. Everything is tucked in. If they get backed into a corner, they will attack if they must, but that would be a last resort. Lest you think cats are always defensive around each other, let's be clear. Cats do have friendly full-body gestures, namely rolling and rubbing. Body rolls happen when a female is in heat, but male cats roll too. Many cats roll in response to catnip, but they also roll in the presence of other, usually older cats. Much like the tail-up signal, rolling seems to be a way to signal, "I'm friendly and unthreatening." Rolling is rarely seen during antagonistic encounters between cats. Belly up is a play solicitation in kittens, although in adults it could serve as a defensive posture, as their teeth and all four paws are readily available for protection in this position. Those belly-up adults are generally not interested in starting trouble, but it can indicate a willingness to defend themselves if necessary. See the cat hug later in this chapter for more about belly-up cats. Yawning and stretching are good signs that your cat is feeling mellow. A relaxed cat will often lay with all paws folded under the body, in what is often referred to as the meatloaf position. All of the cat's weapons are tucked away, and there's no immediate intention to run or defend. The Sphinx is another relaxed pose, where the front legs are extended in front of the body. A truly content cat will be in one of these poses with very drowsy eyes. Both of these poses must be distinguished from crouching, a tense position, where a cat might be hunched over or partially propped up on the front legs. Often you will see tension in the face or tight blinking of the eyes. In cats, this is usually a sign of pain. Because cats hide pain so well, it is important to pay attention to these subtle behaviors. Is your cat annoyed? Many guardians think their cat bites apropos of nothing, but most cats give many warnings, although these warnings may be subtle. Some cats may walk away or turn their back to you, and that is their way of removing themselves from an interaction. Or maybe you're seeing some tail swishing or back twitching. A paw swipe is also a warning, as if to say, "I don't like this and you need to respect that. Next time, there might be teeth or claws." See overstimulation in section 4 for more on warning signs of irritation. Cat Daddy Dictionary. The cat hug. When a cat goes belly up for you, we call this the cat hug, because often it's the closest you will get to a cat actually hugging you. To fully appreciate this, you must understand the genetic experience of being a prey animal. By exposing their belly to you, they are essentially saying, "I am 100% vulnerable to you right now." You could take your claw and eviscerate me down this line from my throat to my groin and essentially tear me open. It is the most vulnerable part of my body, and I am flipping over and showing it to you. Just like the body roll, it is a message of trust. Now, is this an invitation to put your hand on your cat's belly? No! Again, if you respect their protective instinct as a prey animal and understand what every bone in their body is telling them, then you will appreciate the cat hug from a safe distance, unless you've already established a clear and comfortable relationship with your cat that would include belly rubs. Also, as mentioned, because this position is sometimes used as a defensive one, it's very easy for cats to suddenly bite or scratch if they perceive your hand near their belly as a threat. How the cat communicates as a social animal. Olfaction and pheromones. As stalk and rush hunters, cats don't use their sense of smell much for hunting. In contrast to dogs, who might track prey for long distances, cats follow prey only a short distance. But smell is critical to how cats relate to each other. Their sense of smell is approximately 14 times as strong as ours, and it's important to remember that olfactory information talks straight to the part of the brain that is key to emotions and motivations, such as anxiety and aggressions. Cats can also detect pheromones with their vomeronasal organ, VNO, also called the Jacobson's organ. Pheromones are special chemical signals that reveal information about sex, reproductive status, and individual identity. You might have seen your cat make an open-mouth sniff or grimace, which is called the Flamen response. This behavior is a sign that a cat is taking in those pheromones, usually via the urine of other cats. From that flamen response, they know who has been around, when they've been around, and possibly even their emotional state. Are they a familiar cat? Are they an intruder? A female in heat? An intact male? Are they stressed out? This information can be used to help cats avoid contact and conflict with other cats. Urine spray elicits a lot of sniffing in cats, especially if it is the urine of an unfamiliar cat. But strange urine doesn't necessarily cause cats to avoid an area. It's not necessarily a keep-out sign. Pheromones. Cats can leave pheromone messages through glands in their cheeks, forehead, lips, chin, tail, feet, whiskers, pads, ears, flanks, and mammary glands. Rubbing these glands against objects or individuals leaves the cat scent behind. The functions of all the different pheromones are still mojo mysteries, but researchers have identified the functions of three facial pheromones. One pheromone, F2, is a message from tomcat saying, "I'm ready to mate." The pheromone F3 is released during cheek or chin rubbing on objects and helps cats claim ownership of their territory. Finally, F4 is a social pheromone to mark familiar individuals, human, cat, or other. F4 reduces the likelihood of aggression between cats and facilitates the recognition of other individuals. How cats rub to mark can tell you a little bit about their emotional state. Cheek rubbing is generally a sign of confidence, and head bonking against you is a sign of cat love. Scratching is another way for cats to mark their turf, but sometimes cats will also release alarm pheromones when scratching. Urine marking is both a sexual behavior and a response to territorial changes, such as new animals or objects. While urine marking is a completely normal feline behavior, in some ways, it is the antithesis of facial marking. It's the Napoleonic response to territorial anxiety. What makes cats raw is what unites them all. The ties that bind, however, only tell half the story. As we complete our exploration of all cats, it's time to start digging deeper to discover what it is that makes your cat one of a kind. Now, let's get to know your companion better. Much, much better. 5. The Mojo Archetypes and the Confident Wear. At this point, I hope I've painted a good picture of cats as a whole. All cats. How they, in the context of their raw life outside, free from the confines of your home, use the tools that evolution has graced them with to accomplish their daily objectives. The almost reflexive pursuit of these goals creates a cat springboard of sorts into the deep pool of cat mojo. Now it's time to start thinking about how we can take this all-cat info and bring it to our cats. Whether that means using the raw cat to bring out the best in your companion cats, or finding out how our home territory can maximize their mojo and improve our daily relationship with our cats. The Mojo Archetypes. Truth be told, I was never a big fan of types, of reducing anyone to a handful of characteristics. As a matter of fact, that's why I've ditched the term cat behaviorist after my name. Talk about reductive. It makes it seem as if all I do is look at a four-legged bag of symptoms and arrange the puzzle pieces so that it becomes a perfect connect-the-dots collection of behaviors. Wouldn't you be just a little peeved if your therapist referred to herself as a human behaviorist? Feels more than a little cold, right? That said, I unfortunately don't have the time to get to know every cat to the degree that I would like. In the span of a few hours, I have to get through the handshake, the observations of environmental and family dynamics, challenge line exercises, diagnosis, homework assignments, and wrap-up. With cat mojo as the end result I want to promise every animal and human client, I found that underneath every individual cat I meet, there is a claim that he or she has staked along with the mojo spectrum. Without pigeonholing, I have found that guardians and I both benefit from identifying where their cat is and where they want to get to on that spectrum. Cat mojo begins with confident ownership of territory, but by the time we've done our work to raise their mojo bar, it's not just about ownership, but pride. And it's not about territory, but home. Knowing where your cat falls on the mojo spectrum gives us a clearer sense of what our goals look like. And so I created the Mojo Archetypes. Allow me to introduce you to the Mojito Cat, the Napoleon Cat, and the Wallflower. The Mojito Cat. You've got new neighbors, and a couple of weeks after they move in, they invite you to come over. A bit of a housewarming, get-to-know-you type of thing. You knock on their door, and you are immediately met by a level of exuberance that knocks you off your feet a bit. Your new neighbor greets you with a huge smile, welcoming you by name and offering a warm hug as if you've known each other for years. You're being hugged with one arm because you notice the other hand is holding a tray of drinks. Mojito, she asks. We've got a few different flavors here. This one is more limey, that one has a little more cucumber. These have salt on the rim and those don't. You pause, still somewhat in a state of shock. She laughs, seeing that you're a bit quiet, but she just hands you one of the drinks and leads you gently by the elbow inside. Let me show you around. Your first stop is the fireplace, where you're shown pictures on the mantel of vacations, birthdays, weddings. Your hostess stops to pick up an antique picture, lovingly running her finger over it as she talks about the bond she had with her grandmother. She cries a few tears, wipes them away, and the tour continues. You're taken through every nook and cranny. And, incredibly, there seems to be history in every one of them. And through this show and tell, you find yourself invested in this unfolding story. Wait a minute. You stop in your tracks. These people just moved in here? It looks and feels like they've been here for years. And it's not just the arrangement of things, the mementos, the furniture, even magnets and to-do lists on the fridge. It goes deeper than that. It's a vibe. You are just awestruck that 2 weeks ago the moving trucks left this house, and today, it's a home. Your hostess with the mostest, you notice, is not running around trying to impress, nervously throwing coasters under your mojito. You realize that this sense of ease comes from the fact that she's not here to impress. She's not interested in the status that would come from being perfect. She just wants to know you, and she wants you to know her. There's no artifice in this home. And the escape plan that you had in your back pocket? It stays there. Why? Because you want to stay here. Now, imagine if this human were a cat. Then, as soon as you walk into the home, this cat walks right down the center of the room, tail held high, chest up, ears are forward to explore, but not flicking in all directions as if trying to pick up on clues about this incoming being. Eyes are also forward, but to greet, not to check out the periphery for escape routes. Instead of presenting a tray of drinks, the Mojito Cat begins to do figure eights between your legs and those of anyone else who crosses his path. You reach a hand down to say hi. He takes your outstretched fingers and pushes them to his forehead, his cheeks. Simultaneously, he is inviting contact with a stranger, allowing pleasure from the contact, and marking you in a confident way, turning you into his human scent soaker. As you walk into the family room, he climbs to the third level of the cat tree that stands near the door, showing you how he surveys the domain, displaying pride in what is his. You walk into the kitchen. He scoots ahead of you and digs into his dinner as you settle into a conversation. The scratching post in the living room gets a workout when you and the Mojito Cat pass through again. And with every stop on this tour, you are head-butted and cheek-marked. And finally, as you settle on the couch for conversation, he falls asleep, either on or next to you. The Mojito Cat lies at the center of our mojo meter. He is a true north of confidence. He has nothing to prove. He is Tony Manero strutting through Brooklyn. His love for, pride in, and unquestioned ownership of his territory are what makes it his home. The Mojito Cat is marked by this characteristic. He loves his environment so much that he just wants to share it. This is evidenced by his actions in his surroundings and with the beings who populate that environment. And that, folks, is what true cat mojo looks like. The Mojito Cat occupies the center. He gives us a target to aim for and a planet for our other two archetypes to orbit around. While Mojito is so confident he wants to show off his home to you, offering to share its riches, our other two cats are marked by their deep insecurities. Instead of exhibiting grounded ownership, our other cat archetypes are either petrified that you're going to take away what they have or feel that they aren't worthy to have ever owned anything in the first place. Enter our second archetype, the Napoleon Cat, a.k.a. the Overowner. I grew up in New York City during a time when gang activity was so rampant that it felt normal. My parents taught me where I would be safe to travel and where I would not be. After falling asleep on a bus one day, I found myself overshooting home by about 20 blocks. I cautiously got off the bus and went across Broadway to wait for the next bus heading back toward home. As I crossed to the downtown side of the street, I was stopped by a kid. I mean, he couldn't have been older than I was at the time, around 13. I don't remember the name of the gang he was part of, but I knew he was a member. Why? Well, to begin with, he wore a denim vest, frayed at the shoulders, with the name of the gang on it, both on the front and the back. He put himself squarely in my path, puffing out his chest and folding his arms. "You know where you are?" he said, his face inches from mine. "Let me tell you." And he motioned to a huge tag, the name of his gang in white paint on the side of a brick building. I remember being profoundly confused as to what he actually wanted from me. I assumed he had some kind of weapon on him because I was taught to believe that, but he never brandished it. He just stood in front of me, eyes narrowed to slits and his entire being ready to take action. This kid clearly didn't want to kill me, but with every passing second he was, at the very least, growing more and more impatient with my lack of recognition. He wasn't trying to bar entry onto their turf, unless, of course, I was a member of a rival gang. He just wanted me to acknowledge that this belonged to them. It struck me, through my vaguely adrenalized state, how young yet intimidating he was. His arms folded posture, his bowed-up torso, and all of the elements of gang wardrobe. Together, they created a uniform of fear that had been mastered by so many kids back then. And there were so many gangs to house all of the disenfranchised kids who needed a family to feel part of. One of those gangs could easily land on that particular corner later on in the week and tag over this kid's gang tag with their own. Then this kid would come back to his corner and tag again. They needed to tell competing gangs and the world at large that this wall, this block, this neighborhood belonged to them. And don't you forget it. I wanted to answer his question, I really did, but I couldn't. I was, instead, readying myself for violence. Every muscle in my body tightened. I tried to return a somewhat tough glare, but I was definitely a fish out of water in that respect. I tried to walk around him, and he slid in front of me. I went the other direction, and he shifted back. I'm not sure what I did next, but my body posture must have been such a clear sign of surrender that this kid actually laughed at me. Full-throated, head-back, laughed. That cackle served as the final nail in the coffin of my pride. Having snuffed me out like a cigarette under his shoe, his pride sated and his territory unquestionably safe, he finally let me pass. In a sense, he needed to bolster his sense of ownership through intimidation and humiliation. He had to make sure I was completely beaten before he could wear his own crown. This instinct was the nature of gangs. What this one kid did to me, the gangs did to entire neighborhoods. The collective mojo of these communities suffered under the weight of the muggings, the endless tagging, the warfare that had blocks divvied up by a violent few in the name of ownership. Although the Napoleon complex is not a recognized condition, the term has been used throughout the ages to describe an over-owner, like my gang member, because deep down they have absolutely no faith in their ownership. The goal becomes lost in the pursuit. They need to see another person's loss to reassure themselves of the space they occupy. We see Napoleons on a global scale, fundamentalists who would destroy ancient artifacts, leaders who conduct a scorched earth policy when they sense their power slipping. In the world of the Napoleon, if he can't own it, nobody can. And yes, all of this applies to the ultimate practitioner of anti-mojo, the Napoleon cat. When you encounter a Napoleon cat in his territory, you will be greeted with his ears forward, his eyes zeroed in on you just a little, and perhaps a crouching, even aggressive posture. His initial thought is, "Who are you, and what are you here to steal?" True to the complex that is his namesake, he is paranoid about the prospects of takeover and overcompensates accordingly. And in this cat's home, he will ambush others when they least expect it, even when those people and animals have already abdicated their position day after day. If a cat could fold his arms, the Napoleon would find a way. Instead of greeting you at the door with a tray of mojitos, the Napoleon will stand across the doorway or right in the center of the foot traffic, just like the gang member from my youth. But in the Napoleon cat's world, graffiti is sprayed not with paint, but with urine. We see that lack of mojo on display when he paints the perimeter of your home under windows and on doors, as if to say, "If I want to protect this castle, I should damn well build a moat." It's interesting that, in the years of one-on-one work I've done since defining the archetypes, I've noticed that the Napoleon cat gets very little love, very little empathy. If we want our Napoleon to inch his way towards the center, towards his best mojito self, empathy is what it takes. We can't save all of our parental protection skills for our final archetype.
The Wallflower, a.k.a. the Victim. Although the Wallflower is a pretty self-explanatory archetype, knowing you have one is usually confirmed by someone visiting your home. They will ask, "You have another cat? I thought you had only one." The Wallflower is a closet cat, an under-the-bed cat, someone whose primary objective is to remain unnoticed, safe from scrutiny. She is the only one who politely hopes you won't notice her as she sneaks by. While the overowner is lying across the doorway and the mojito cat is walking around shouting, "Hey, how you doing?" the Wallflower is hanging back against the wall, hence her moniker, never once daring to walk across the middle of the floor. The Wallflower is saying, "I don't own this. I assume you must be the owner," which is totally fine, but if it wouldn't be too much trouble, I'm just going to the litter box over there. I'm not looking at you, just leaving. Don't mind me. Goodbye. And she leaves with a blink and you miss her, tail-tucked run, or the Wallflower special, the army crawl exit stage left. Ironically, it is the Wallflower's display of anti-mojo, slinking around the periphery, avoiding confrontation at all cost, deferring, and often being overly fearful and shy, that leads to her role as the victim in multi-cat homes, a role often referred to as the pariah. In such homes, you find her caving in the closet or under the bed, or sometimes cornering herself on a shelf or on top of the fridge. In extreme circumstances, our Wallflower feels unable to come down from those safe zones, to the point where they may even poop and pee in those zones. Like the Napoleon cat at the other end of the confidence pendulum, the Wallflower cat is also anti-mojo because hiding is reactive, not active. It doesn't matter whether the threat is real or imagined, it still requires her full attention and prompt action. We want all cats to be their version of mojito cats. In other words, not expecting them to conform to what we think confidence should look like, but acknowledging their tendencies and easing their anxieties to make them the best mojito cat they can be. What tends to be a hindrance in getting both Napoleon and Wallflower towards mojito land is our ingrained feelings about them. The Napoleon tends to get our scorn, and the Wallflower our pity. The Napoleon gets locked away in a room where she can't beat anyone up, while the Wallflower gets special treatment in her safe zones, which could mean a dish on top of the fridge or under the bed, or a cushy bed inside the closet. As the old saying goes, the road to ruin is paved with good intentions. The only road to Mojito Land goes right through the challenge line. At home with a raw cat. In the wild, a cat's territory isn't defined by walls, doors, or windows. Cats create their own maps and establish their own boundaries. Most cats have a core area that they identify as home. The size of their territory beyond that core may depend on whether they are male or female, how much prey is in the area where they live, what type of predators are around, the availability of mates, and how much direct competition there is. In the absence of doors and walls, cats mark the space they occupy with territorial markers. But if we were to zoom in on what unites all felines, from lions to our cats, it's not just that they are territorial. It's how they express that territoriality. All cats use markers, or signposts, by urine marking, scratching, rubbing their cheeks and other areas that have scent glands, and perhaps even by pooping, to delineate their turf. The raw cat uses scratch marks to define frequently traveled pathways and will cheek rub on fences or fallen branches. Urine is used to mark the loose boundaries of a cat's range on prominent objects like tree stumps. As mentioned in the last chapter, marking behaviors say, "I live here," not necessarily "keep out." Urine marks transmit information about how recently the cat was here and what his or her reproductive status is. Spraying ramps up during mating season. But the whole point of all these signposts is to allow cats to coexist without fighting. It's like leaving the message, "Hey, I'd like to reserve this space from 2 to 4 p.m. Cool?" It folds into the feline style of avoiding conflict, securing resources, food, alone, and time-sharing as need be. Of course, we all know that sometimes cats don't agree, and that's when fights break out. But signposts help cats identify where and when they exist, and that's why they are so important to your cat, especially because we define their boundaries by keeping them indoors. The confident where. We've already established that cats see territory in a three-dimensional way that other species, including humans, don't. For instance, when we bipeds walk into a room, we take in its assets based on what's sitting on the floor. We scope out the most comfortable chair, our couch, the best seat in proximity to a window, or the TV, even the best place to drop our wallet and keys. Let's face it, we are very much terrestrial. Cats, on the other hand, take in every square inch from floor to ceiling, assessing possible rest spots, advantageous perches where they can survey the comings and goings of other beings who share their turf, and spots where they can camouflage themselves to prey, play, or just disappear from the world. Mojo's swagger is partially based, as I've mentioned before, on that feeling of being home. A baseball player's mojo is derived not only from his daily three R's, which in his case might be batting practice, physical therapy, how he puts on his uniform, etc., but also from where those rituals take place, at the ballpark. If we took Tony Manero out of his Brooklyn neighborhood and deposited him on Staten Island, would he still possess his mojo? Most likely not. Similarly, a cat's mojo is not strictly about her ability to hunt, to complete each step of the raw cat rhythm. Cats also create confidence based on where in the territory they tend to be most successful. Your cat will find various territorial sweet spots somewhere on the vertical axis and claim them. Each cat has a preferred vantage point in the vertical world, or what I call the confident where. Our job is to discover and encourage their relationship to these places, which allows them to step into their greatness full of mojo and prepare themselves to take on the world. All we have to do is observe. When your cat walks into a room, where is he looking? Many cats will walk in, head high, looking straight up, as if to say, "That! I want that!" Identifying with mojo a specific area along the vertical axis is what I call dwelling. Discovering what kind of dweller your cat is will go a long way towards creating a long-lasting, mojified territory and equally mojified cat. Consider the following three categories. Types of dwellers. Bush dwellers are the cats waiting under the coffee table or behind a plant. They are often in the raw cat mindset, waiting to hunt or pounce. Bush dwellers like to have all 4 feet on the ground. Tree dwellers can be found anywhere off the ground. These cats get their confidence from being up high and seeing what's going on. They're not necessarily up in the rafters, but they might be on a chair or on top of the couch. They demonstrate their confidence off the floor. Beach dwellers like all 4 feet touching terra firma, but rather than waiting under a coffee table, they let it all hang out. Beach dwellers like being out in the open. This is the cat you trip over every day. They're sending a message to you and everyone else in the home. You have to walk around me. But before you label your cat a beach, tree, or bush dweller, you need to know the difference between dwelling and hiding. You can tell if cats are dwelling by their body language. Their ears are forward, and they are surveying the landscape, but they are not vigilant. Hiding is notably different. It's about being small and invisible. It's what we call the unconfident where. Crouching down is not about comfort, and seeking safety is not about confidence. If your cat hides all the time or spends most of his time under the bed, he is not a confident bush dweller. Similarly, your cat is not likely a tree dweller just because he lives on top of the refrigerator. Which brings us to, fridging is when a cat lives on the fridge, up high but still fearful. Although this behavior pulls on every one of our heartstrings, this is a living situation that you simply shouldn't allow to persist. If your cat shows you that he doesn't just prefer to be up there, but needs to, and you're feeding him there, you're not addressing the situation at hand. He's trying to get away from something, usually other animals or people. He only feels safe there because there is something on the floor that is like broken glass to him. In addition, caves are places where cats go to hide, and when they're hiding out in a cave out of fear, we call it caving. We tend to encourage caving by giving cats everything they need in their cave. We feed them under the bed or bring their litter box to them in a misguided attempt to help them feel safe. But caving doesn't make cats feel safe. It just makes them small. Cats often hide in what we call the unders, This could be the furthest corner under the bed, in the box spring of a mattress, deep in the back of a closet, or even a hole in the wall. I've seen it all. The unders represent the ultimate in caves. Eventually, all of the unders need to be removed or made inaccessible to your cat by blocking them off. But we're not going to just rip away your cat's sense of safety. Cat Daddy.